Let's gavel in. All right, let's call this meeting of the House Health and Social Service Committee to order. It is 3:03 p.m. and the date is
19th.
Okay, February 19th, 2013. I was going to say the 18th, but it's 19th. Okay, let's see here. Present will be Representative Reinbold, Representative Tarr, and myself, Representative Higgins, and Representative Keller. He's here. Representative Seaton is excused for the day. I would like to recognize our staff. We have Butch Carver as our House Recording Secretary, and we have, is it Henry, right? Henry as our LIO moderator, Paul Verhagen, my committee aide. We're going to be listening to a couple of presentations today. So with that said, anyone that has their cell phones on, if you could turn them off, it's just, you know, good to do that. If it rings, you owe us all donuts, okay? So let's not let that happen. All right. So our first presentation will be the Tribal Behavioral Directors Committee, and the second will be the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. We'll invite the TBDC presenters to come to the table, and if they would state their names and their roles for the record, when they are ready, we can begin the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Can you hear me fine?
Is that on? Say it again.
Can you hear me fine?
Yep.
There you go. My name is Tina Woods, and I am with the Aleutian Pueblo Islands Association.
Good afternoon. My name is Shanda Aloysius. I'm the Vice President of South Central Foundation and also the Vice Chair of the Tribal Behavioral Health Directors. I'm Athabasca Indian and Yupik Eskimo, and my family comes from Holy Cross.
Thank you. Go ahead, begin.
All right, and I'd like to add to my introduction. I'm Anungan, originally from St. Paul Island, so thank you very much for having us here today. As you'll notice, on our executive committee, Angela Cox, our secretary, was weathered in Barrow, so she'll be joining us later. So we wanted to...
Before you begin, let me just do one more shopkeeping. We'd like to recognize Representative Nagek and Representative Pruitt. Go ahead.
Thank you. We wanted to share with you a little bit about who we are, and as a part of the overall tribal health system, the Behavioral Health Directors Committee was created in 2005 and approved by the Alaska Native Health Board in 2008. We have 24 members, and you'll notice right behind us in the audience, many of our representatives throughout the state, our Tribal Behavioral Health Directors Committee. They can just kind of raise their hand. You'll see we have several of them with us, and if we have questions today, we may suggest that they help respond. We meet quarterly. This is our in-person meeting here in Juneau, and we employ over 800 individuals within the tribal behavioral health system. So you can just imagine we provide an array of services throughout the state, both rural and urban.
So some of the services that we want to share with you that we provide, it is through grants from the state of Alaska. It is through funding from the Indian Health Service, and it is also through private grants as well as the ability to bill Medicaid and private insurance. But up on the screen there, I won't read through all of them, but as a collective group of tribal behavioral health providers, we provide a wide range of services, ranging from your outpatient, more traditional individual and group therapies. We do prevention and intervention with suicide. We work with our customer owners and our Alaska Native American Indian people that suffer with domestic violence. We serve the severely mentally ill adults. We serve our severely emotionally disturbed youth. We have residential treatment programming. We have detox facilities. We provide case management. And really, I want to emphasize that we offer crisis response throughout the state, and we'll be talking a little bit more about that in our presentation. And finally, we do a lot of training. One of the things that was very difficult in our large, great state is training, and one of the things that we provide is trauma-based training. We also do a lot of training around family, and we have our Family Wellness Warriors Initiative that has gone into many, many regions across the state of Alaska to provide training.
So growing our own is something that we take a lot of pride in. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with the Tribal Behavioral Health Aid model. This is a model that's federally recognized through the Community Health Aid Program and certification process. Currently, we have approximately 134 behavioral health aid providers throughout the state, and we can break that down to 87 behavioral health aid trainees, 47 are certified, and those certifications are across the board from behavioral health aid 1 to 10 of them, 19 behavioral health aid practitioners, and 18 behavioral health aid 3s. So these individuals are trained and certified to provide a broad range of behavioral health services throughout the state of Alaska. These are the frontline workers. These are the individuals that, if I can make a strong statement here, these are the individuals.
Excuse me, just for I don't mean to interrupt you. Uh-huh. For the committee members here, the PowerPoint that we're given is different than what we're seeing. This one's an up-to-date one, apparently.
This is, Mr. Chair, and we did deliver updated handouts. So,
okay. I have.
Really? Am I the only one that doesn't have one? But it's okay. That's fine. We're getting one. We're getting one. Okay. I just wanted the committee members. So if they got the same one I've got, then we're one behind.
Okay.
So, okay, go ahead.
For that. So I just really wanted to emphasize that our behavioral health aides, probably the most significant value to their position is keeping individuals out of residential treatment facilities such as API, Alaska Psychiatric Institute, North Star, and Providence. These are the individuals that many of them were born and raised in their communities and are the frontline workers and providing services. Later in this presentation, we will talk a little bit about one of the challenges that we have with billing services for these individuals.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Nygaard, go ahead.
Can we ask questions?
You
later
can.
Or?
No. Would you prefer we ask them all in the end or as we go?
As we go would be great.
As we go.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the prevention, intervention, treatment on substance use, and especially mental health disorders or mental health problems, I know each region has problems with mental health problems, but a lot of the people with those problems are sent away. And in Barrow, where I'm from, I've been asked, to bring back some of those people to open a program in regional areas, like regional centers like Barrow, Bethel, Kotzebue, as such, because I think in order for those people with those problems to heal, at least to be around family, I think it's a whole lot better than being away from family. I know it helps a lot, but there's no centers. There's nothing especially in regional centers to take care of those people with mental health problems. We'd like to have some homes in those regions to address those to address that very real problem. And whenever they come home, you can see a change in some of those patients, and they don't want to go back, but they can't stay because there's no place to help them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome.
I'm going to back up here. This map right here gives you a visual of our community health aides throughout the state. And through Representative Higgins, Mr. Chair, in response to Representative Nagiak.
Yes.
In response to the comment that you made about facilities to be built throughout the state in our hub communities for the mentally ill, I agree with you. That's something that I think each individual organization is probably looking at individually. You know, funding is definitely one of the biggest barriers there. Some of us are still trying to build clinics, you know, just the basics, much less to build substance use, substance abuse residential treatment centers, and then residential treatment centers that are culturally responsive mm-hmm. to bring our people home. So thank you for your comment on that.
Thank you.
So I'm going to move on here. So we wanted to share with you, how does the state benefit from working with the tribal behavioral health system? And some of this may not be new to you, but we're going to share it. The state is eligible for 100% reimbursement from the federal government for the services that we provide. That's a really huge partnership that we have with the state in providing services statewide. And then we also take a lot of pride in being able to effectively provide services in a culturally responsive way and working with our elders and our behavioral health aides to do so.
One of the things I'd like to share about that FMAP that you see up there, reimbursement, this is something that would be cost neutral to the state. We're always talking about cost neutral ideas, and working with tribal providers providing these mental health and substance use services will create that opportunity. I really want to point out, for those of you that are familiar with our community health aid model, with our dental health aid model, this is the behavioral health model that we're sharing with you. And our behavioral health aides in the villages, they really do help keep our people in the village. They're usually partnered with master's level clinicians, psychologists, and psychiatrists as the level of need is higher than they can meet. But they do that in partnership so that they can keep our Alaska Native people in their communities. So they're not presenting to our urban areas using our emergency rooms, which are very expensive, and are getting put into inpatient units, which are very, very expensive. And then the healing then is really questionable because they're not with their people. So it's really, I really just wanted to point out that this behavioral health aid model and is oftentimes the sole provider in a village that has any behavioral health training at all. And we'll talk more about the compassion fatigue, I'll put it that way, that these providers are suffering.
Representative Reinbold?
Just a real quick question here. It's good, you know, if you're trying to, you know, be cost effective. I think that's really good, and you may be getting to this, but do you use any e-medicine or face-to-face time via technology or anything like that? Because this question comes up quite often, and I don't know if you have the bandwidths in all the areas, but do you use that to help reduce costs?
Through the chair, Representative Reibold, one of the things that we will be getting to in our presentation is that some facilities are equipped to do video conferencing, which we like to call telepsychiatry. Mm-hmm. We have challenges with that, with the bandwidth, the cost of the facilities, the cost of the equipment, and just to be quite frank with you, the weather will prevent the video conferencing from taking place, so sessions can be missed. As you know, if we can't use the telephone, it's not reimbursable. We use it anyway to keep those, you know, the communication happening. What happens with some of our providers that are psychiatric nurse practitioners and psychiatrists using that method to provide a service is, you know, we try our best to train them about what it's like to be in a village and the resources available in a village. But they'll sit there and they'll prescribe a medication, but that customer owner on the other end of that video line may not get that medication for a month due to weather. Planes won't be able to fly in. They won't have that kind of medication there, or there might be errors. And so the next time they have a check-in with them, a med check, to say, how are you doing on your medication, they may not even have them. And the psychiatrist is usually surprised. What do you mean you don't have them? I ordered them for you. And so those are technical difficulties we're working through, but the opportunities to really use that technology is still there, and we're not using it to its potential.
Thank you.
And just for, you know, my information, the behavioral health aid, that's the same as the community health aid, correct? That the communities have?
It's the same model as the community health aid program and the dental health aid program.
Right. Well, it's not another person. It's the same person. It's just, or is it a completely different person?
Mr. Chair, it is a completely different person.
That's what I wanted to clarify. Somebody asked me that. Is that the same as the community health aid? And I go, well, I'm not sure.
The community health aid is an excellent model. It's been around for years and years and years. In fact, my 90-year-old grandmother was one of the first health aides in our village, and it's a fantastic model. This behavioral health aid model is based off of that, but it is, in fact, a paraprofessional trained that is usually Alaska Native that comes from the village in which they're providing a service, and it is a separate person than the community health aid.
And where do they get their training at?
The behavioral health aides throughout the state have several trainings that they can attend, Mr. Chair. One of them is put on through the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the Rural Human Services Program. I believe YKHC also has a training program through their locally based. Mr. Chair, do you mind if I refer back to somebody in the audience that might actually be able to elaborate on that?
That would be fine, okay.
Ms. Hamrick? Will you please respond to that?
Most of the training is done through AMTC, a yearly forum that takes place usually in November. That's a week long, and so that's a time that we can bring all of the behavioral health aides in, as well as through Essential Learning, and it's a program that they can connect in their communities to take different courses that are outlined in the behavior health certification manual.
Can you just state your name and
Janice Hammer.
And your affiliation for the record?
Search.
Thank you.
Okay, so this next slide briefly summarizes our priorities. We have three categories of priorities that we are focusing on this year, many of them that are impacting us currently, some of them that we've been dealing with for a very long time. So these include access to care, shortage in services, and some of them include state requirements. So priority one, access to care. This is really any individual that enters treatment. Behavioral health services, if they have a mental health issue, substance abuse issue, when they enter treatment, regardless of what culture you come from, there are many barriers to picking up that phone and telling somebody, a perfectly strange person, that you have an issue that you need to deal with. And so in addition to that, there are additional barriers for Alaska Native people and the Alaska Native population specifically. And when you look at the high rates, all the statistics out there, and the high rates of social issues that we face as a people, you will also find stats showing that the service utilization of mental health services are much lower than the mainstream population. So what's happening is our stats are high and our service utilization is low, which is why the behavioral health aid program works, because individuals feel comfortable talking to somebody from their own community. So our first issue that we're battling is the documentation requirements. When someone comes in for services, the packet is about that thick for being able to have your first individual therapy session with a provider. There are tools and instruments that are required by the state of Alaska for individuals to receive services and for us to bill services, including a very comprehensive assessment packet. And it's pretty invasive, and many of our Alaska Native elders will not receive services, will not seek services as a result of this very invasive process. And in addition to that, in order for one individual to receive their first individual therapy session, there's about 5 to 8 hours of paperwork to be processed in order for the individual to receive services. So this is a really huge problem, and it's a huge barrier for us. Venue requirements, this is another barrier that we face. And again, I will use elders as an example for this. Policies do not support culturally responsive options such as in-home assessments with elders. So in order for us to conduct an assessment with an elder, it's very difficult to do because you can't go into the home and conduct the assessment. The elder has to come to the clinic for the service. So these are two huge barriers that we face. There's no ability to bill for such services, no reimbursement options for our behavioral health aides right now at this time, and they are the first contact for our clients. Do you have anything else to add on that, Shonda?
One important piece of information to leave you about working in the field of mental health and substance use is it takes a lot of courage for a human being to walk into that type of an office and ask for help. And when they're greeted with a binder of information thicker than the books behind you on your shelf, it's a barrier in itself. And when you're not talking to the human being in front of you to really understand the challenges that they're facing, and instead they have to fill out what their income level is, how many people that live in their household, what is their presenting problem, and they give you five different axes types of diagnoses, that doesn't help them. That doesn't help Alaska Native people. They want to know why they're hurting in their hearts and in their minds and in their bodies. And until we find a way to bring wellness at that level to our communities, and find a way to simplify this documentation that's required, we are never going to get there. Alaska will continue to lead the indicators nationwide with suicide, substance use, sexual assaults on our women and our children. It's never going to end.
Is that documentation all federal regs that you're talking about?
It's the state of Alaska Medicaid, new Medicaid regulations, and no offense to the commissioner and his staff, but they are quite extensive if you look at them. It could take between 4 to 8 hours to do an intake assessment. 4 hours if you're a seasoned master's level clinician with many, many years under your belt, a new person that we're getting right out of school unlicensed from the University of New Mexico, because that's where we get a few of them. It'll take them a lot longer because they just don't understand what they're filling out.
Okay. And in addition to that, Mr. Chair, what happens is individuals come in and they immediately, after the first couple sessions of paperwork, they immediately shut down and they don't return. I guess one of the things that we would ask of this committee that we want to ask of you is, you know, we would love for the state to consider offering another category for us to provide services, which we would refer to as a brief intervention category. Currently, we are allowed to see a client in crisis and bill for that through a one-time crisis response, crisis intervention. But we would love to see a brief intervention category which allows us to see an individual, especially to be more culturally responsive to individuals who already have that wall up and it took them a lot of courage to come in and receive services, to see them maybe once, twice, three, four times as we build that relationship and that rapport with them so that they feel safe, trusting, and comfortable to fully engage and come into our system.
Our priority two, Mr. Chair, really talks about shortages in services. And if I may, I'd like to just kind of start with a story about our statewide crisis response and the shortage that we have in this area. Just this last summer, we had a plane crash in McGrath, which is an area that we serve in with South Central Foundation. And on that airplane is a school teacher from Anvik. On that airplane is family members of the people of McGrath. On that airplane is people that are well known in the community. It was teachers going and working with the Iditarod School District. And again, that community has a behavioral health aide that's in Nikolai to respond. We do have a clinic that's out there, but we had to send response teams from Anchorage, but the team that was on the ground was able to handle it really well. One of the things that I think is really important is that the state of Alaska really needs to partner with the villages. They need to know who the leaders are in the village. They need to know who the tribal leader is. They need to know who the principals are. They need to know who the teachers are. They need to know who the leaders are in that community, and the state really needs to help by responding to crises across the state. So when we have communities that we have clusters of suicides, as another example, and there's suicides up to six of them at a time in different hubs, if you would, of Alaska, those providers in those areas get really, really tired. They get compassion fatigue. They get burnt out, and there isn't anyone to come in and relieve them. And they do, when they do ask for help, they're not sure who to ask for it, you know, whether it's a state agency or another tribal organization. And in the case, we had agencies come to South Central Foundation and ask us for help. And, of course, we do go out and help them. And one of the things that in this particular area that I would like the state to really consider is, in addition to helping coordinate, is to have a large enough pool of money to help for travel. You know how big our state is. We would be willing to pay for the psychiatrists and the psychologists and the master's level that are trained in crisis to respond, their salaries, but we don't have budgets for travel and lodging and per diem and so forth. And oftentimes when there's suicides, the communities do not want you to go in right away. They want to have an opportunity to bury their loved ones and to have some rest, and then they ask for crisis response to come in. But oftentimes that's not described as the definition of a crisis to state people, and the crisis is then over and it's not allowed to be paid for by any means. So it's just to consider, you know, the traditional aspects of the crisis response that we have in our community and to respond. God forbid we have an incident that happened in a school in the lower 48 here in Alaska. What would happen? Who would respond? Would it be the state troopers, only them? Would it be the whole department? Would it be, how would the response happen? How would the which behavioral health provider would show up on the front door? Is it going to be the tribal behavioral health providers? Is it going to be the school? Is it going to be the state providers? It's really something in an area that we should look at for our state and really come up with reasonable, responsible, simple emergency response plans that don't exist today, sir. The second area I'll talk about, which I'm sure is not very, I can go back, is not probably new to you, is Alaska is pretty cold and wet and harsh, and we don't like to have a lot of people come from the lower 48 that won't be able to tolerate our conditions very long. So we do have a shortage of providers. If you could think in the area of Kobuk or Barrow with our colleague Angela, who's not here, we have our providers that are coming in from out of state, and then they are in culture shock coming into our villages. They try their best. They're excited about it. They think it's like going to a third world country and having an experience, and they do have an experience. But as I described with the crisis response, they are the basketball coach. They're also maybe a side tutor. They're also the clinician. You know, they're also probably a janitor, you know, on the side. There might be a partial, you know, of a kind of a peer mentor, maybe helping with some parenting or some stress issues. They're everyone in the village. There's no resources in the village. So when there's a professional in that village, they're everything to that community. And they have no relief. There's no relief. They get tired of all that documentation that Tina talked about. There's too much requirements. And they really just need a balance. On top of that, a lot of them were getting out of schools or not licensed. And the regions can't afford to pay for a clinical supervision. So maybe that's something that the state of Alaska can provide. And the final thing that I'll bring up, Mr. Chair, on this area of provider shortages is potentially the state can do more with loan repayment. You know, instead of counting the number of customers that they have to serve and not counting those that didn't come, maybe we could do a step further and say serve in a rural village and you'll have loan repayment. You know, it's an option that we could think about offering to people that are willing to come and work in our pretty harsh conditions.
Representative Nygaard.
Thank you. Well, thank you for that. That'll be a little hard for me. I know how hard it is to try and cope with someone you love when they take their own lives. I went through that.
Me too.
My son. And if it wasn't for the people in a counselor, grief counselors and such, I don't know how I would be right now. They took care of me and my family when we needed it. and we needed to get it out of our system. But unfortunately, it stays there for a long time. And it constant reminders all the time. So I can imagine how it must be for people who don't have that in their villages. It takes time to heal from that. I'm still healing. It's over almost four years. But I can't stress enough how important it is to have people there to help you when you come across this horrible situation. And another thing, I try to say this all the time, and whenever I tell my colleagues here, whenever I have a platform, I try to use that. Try to use my experience to help other people. And so I want people to understand that if you see someone who's despondent, if you see someone who's like that, have that weight of the world on their shoulders, be rude, butt in. That person that you talk to may be that person who you saved. We don't know. From my experience, I don't know how, or I didn't see it, but it happened. So, but I'm using my experience to help other people, to look at people and to do something. Be rude. Butt in. That person you say, you may be saving that person. And I was lucky, and I really want the staff and counselors and such to be available wherever possible. And I think it's very important to get that support to everybody, because I just don't want anybody to go through that. You need to get that off your mind and body sometimes. So thank you.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative, for sharing your story with us. And if there's one thing that we can ask of this committee to continue, is exactly the point that was just shared, is, again, we can do that initial crisis response, but there's no money to go back in and follow up at 6 months, at 12 months, at 4 years. Mm-hmm. It's not there, and going in one time will hopefully help some. But it's something that we really need to look at and partner better. There's a lot of resources in this state of Alaska, not only with the state, but with tribal organizations that we're teaching you about today, with Indian Health Service, with the Mental Health Trust, with the grants, the private grants that we get from SAMHSA. We just need to coordinate better. This third priority that we'd like to share with you talks again a little bit more about the state of Alaska requirements. There's really needs to be a balance between providing a quality service and accountability. The state of Alaska new Medicaid regulations right now has an unfunded mandate for all behavioral health providers to become accredited by a recognized body of accreditation such as Joint Commission or CARF. I will share a personal story with you right now just from my organization, South Central Foundation. One of my clinics, and I have several, but one of my clinics is currently accredited by Joint Commission Hospital Accreditation. And part of that hospital accreditation is a behavioral health component. And we pay really good money to have that accreditation, and we've had it for years. But just this, a few months ago, the state of Alaska sent me a letter saying, we're not going to recognize that accreditation. That's not good enough. You need to go and get Joint Commission specific behavioral health outpatient accreditation. Therefore, paying an additional $15,000 to $20,000 for surveyors to come on site for us to apply for that, to get that kind of status. And in the meantime, the state mandated that we follow their interim behavioral health standards. That's in Chapter 70 of the Medicaid regulations. So there's all of these unfunded mandates, and South Central Foundation is a good size, but there are other partners and peers of mine in this room that have very small behavioral health programs. How are they going to come up with CARF accreditation with not only all of the requirements to get that, but the money that's unfunded as a mandate to say, go get CARF accreditation, it costs $20,000 or more. And we can't even pay for a master's level clinician to come work in our village. So these are the things that we have to weigh in rural Alaska, and we really need your help to balance that. You know, I always try to come with solutions, but potentially a solution is just to stay, just to use the interim standards that are in the Medicaid regulations. They provide quality outlines. They don't have to cost a lot of money to be accredited formally by one of these bodies or pay for it. Have the state of Alaska pay for every accreditation that's needed that's out there. So that's one area that I just wanted to share with you that is an unfunded mandate that is creating yet another barrier to providing care.
Okay. This next bulleted item, integrated healthcare structure. So many of us are, and it's been suggested at the most recent change agent conference put on by the Division of Behavioral Health, that we want to encourage our healthcare systems to become more integrated, behavioral health and primary care. And unfortunately, as you can see in the sub-bullet, the suggested structure prevents billing options for behavioral health. So I'll give you an example. If a client comes into the clinic, into primary care, to see their medical doctor for maybe some rapid heart rate, and the primary care provider decides, you know, we need to get you in to see, this looks more like anxiety or a panic attack, we need you to see a behavioral health clinician. So that behavioral health clinician will be brought into the room to work with the client or the customer owner. And the individual, the work that the behavioral health clinician conducts with this individual cannot be billed in the primary care setting. So SCF, as an example, has behavioral health consultants that work with primary care who provide services such as the example I gave, thousands of them, which cannot be billed. So this structure does not allow us to bill our services.
And this electronic database system, again, it's just something I want to bring to your attention. The state of Alaska obviously has to collect data, and we have to collect data in some way. The state chooses to use this tool called AKAIMS. A lot of the providers across the state enter what they're calling a minimal data set into it. Others use it as an electronic medical record. The challenge that we're going to have as a state is that with the High Tech Act and the mandate to have an electronic medical record, combined and compounded with the fact that we're trying to integrate behavioral health and primary care, we have a state that's going to have probably 20 to 50 different electronic medical record systems. The healthcare system, just at Alaska Native Medical Center, uses the Cerner platform. It's the Cerner electronic medical record. Right there at South Central Foundation on the same campus, I use SmartChart, which is a NetSmart product for behavioral health, to be compliant with the High Tech Act. And then I enter the minimum data set into AKAIMS. Those are three ways that we have to enter that same information. In this day and age, I can't help but have hopeful thoughts that the technology can talk to each other somehow, some way. And I'm just hoping that, you know, through this committee and through the really wonderful work that the commissioner's office is doing, and even the mental health is trying to facilitate conversations, that we can come to some reasonable solutions other than mandating entry into multiple electronic record sites. It takes away from services and care.
Representative Byrne, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to ask a question.
Oh, go ahead.
The High Tech Act, is that what you said?
Yes.
Who, is it a federal act?
Through the chair.
When was it established?
I know very little about that. It is a federal act that's mandated that healthcare agencies across the country has to have an electronic medical record, and it has to be certified by certain and have certain requirements. There's opportunities. In other words that are used that I hear, because I'm not an IT person at all, you don't want me to touch this computer, I'll break it, is the Meaningful Use Act, where people are getting funding for having an electronic medical record in place sooner. They're getting right now payments in order to get an electronic record and system. My understanding is that's going to become a negative punitive thing, and if you don't have a medical record, electronic medical record in place, you're going to be fined. And it has to meet certain certification requirements, and that's where it gets beyond me. Yeah.
So in summary of our presentation, we wanted to end with sharing with you that we, as a directors, as a committee, we maintain partnerships both with the state and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority regarding the following items there. And, you know, we are an underfunded system. I always refer to behavioral health as the redheaded stepchild. We're always the last to be considered for anything. And many of our regional health organizations, we're all different. We all have a difference in how we operate. I work for one that, fortunately, our health director carves out money from our IHS compact to go towards behavioral health services to improve our services. However, not all organizations have that luxury. So we have to have these partnerships in order to provide this very meaningful service. Behavioral health is really the root of the entire mind, body, spirit. When you look at physical ailments such as obesity, diabetes, all of those are behavioral health issues, and it starts with prevention, and it starts within the mind.
Go ahead, Representative Rambo.
Okay, so you say you have a request in for funding. Is this part of the health and social services budget? I mean, you don't have any specific thing that I can find on here.
As far as requests, throughout the presentation, we try to just kind of point out a few areas that we can request your support. One thing that we did not mention, and excuse me, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, one of the things that we didn't really touch on a whole lot, and it's actually been a conversation between the Tribal Behavioral Health Directors Committee and the state of Alaska, has to do with a document called the State Plan Amendment. And the State Plan Amendment is a document that consists of billing codes to bill for our behavioral health aid model services, just like the dental health aid and the community health aid program. Unfortunately, right now, we are not able to bill for those services, for our behavioral health aid model services. And so the state plan amendment, if it were passed, it would allow us to do that. And right now it is, it's been a discussion since 2008. And as far as I understand, it's with the Center for Medicaid Services at this time. And we're just waiting patiently for that to move forward so that we can bill for such services. Because if we were able to move forward with that SPA, that state plan amendment, it would resolve a lot of the priority issues that we've presented today, or some of them in any case. One of the major ones would be documentation requirements, because the behavioral health aid, the behavioral health aides will be able to provide services. We call it like a cup of coffee type of therapy. Most clients that you will find in rural Alaska that come in for behavioral health services are coming into your door to say, good morning, Tina, and to have some small talk. It's not to come in and have an assessment done. So brief intervention type model therapy. So with the state plan amendment, if that were to move through, which is something that we would look to this committee for support. And that would be the major request that, if I were to summarize this.
Okay, and I do have a follow-up.
Go ahead.
Okay, so are these the CPT codes, the diagnostic codes, or is this in general on a federal level? And second, is Obamacare going to affect this in any way? And when are you waiting for the Center for Medicaid Services to act on that?
It is all of those codes, through the chair, excuse excuse me. It is all of those codes. We've been partnering with the state of Alaska, and they have sent the state plan amendment because they're the ones who have to send it to CMS to consider. We do not know the status of it. We've been working on this since 2008 and really aggressively working on it since 2010. So your guess is as good as mine where it's at. We keep putting the ball in the state court. They keep putting it back in our court, and finally it's back in the state's hands now, and they've given it to CMS. In relation to Obamacare, I do not believe that anything that we're doing in our state is reflected in anything that has to do with Obamacare because it's so specific to our state of Alaska. Again, it's adding codes specifically for tribal providers to bill our behavioral health aides.
Okay. Thank you.
800 employees, who's funding that?
Primarily the Indian Health Service.
Indian Health Service.
Second to that, it's funded by private grants and a very small percentage by the state of Alaska grant funding.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, first, I appreciate coming in and talking with the committee. And I appreciate your hard work that you do out in the rural areas and in your villages. You know, you guys know that better than most of us. I mean, I've been out to a lot of villages. I haven't spent a fair amount of time out there. And I understand that for something to work out there over my years, I know that the village has to endorse it, basically accept it for it to work. And that's what I've learned over the years. And the best way to do that is have entities like you and what you're doing and the training that you're doing. So I certainly do support your hard work. And we'll see what we can do to make sure you continue to do your hard work because there's a lot of people out there that need your help. Okay? Thank you. Well, we'll take a brief at ease while we're waiting for the next presentator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. I hear we're ready, so let's see here. Let's invite the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association presenters to come to the table, state their names, their roles for the record, and let them begin their presentation. And again, for the committee, I guess, is that going to be okay if we ask questions as we go through the presentation?
That'd be good, yes, sir.
Okay, so through the chair. Go ahead.
Good. Well, first of all, thank you very much. My name is Mike Powers. I'm the CEO at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. To my far right is Dr. Andy Mayo, who's the CEO at North Star Behavioral Health. To my immediate right is Lori Dotis, who's the CEO at Prestige Healthcare, long-term care and rehab facility in Anchorage. First thing I'd like to say is thanks for the time you're taking to listen to us, to learn a little bit more about the industry. We, of course, feel we have tough jobs and long hours and many constituents, and I know what you go through every day. So thank you very much for that time. What I'd like to do is just give a brief overview of hospitals and long-term care facilities in Alaska. We're ready for questions at any time. And as we move through the presentation, I will hand off both to Andy and to Lori for their particular sections and to get a glimpse of what we're dealing with. I represent a community hospital in interior Alaska with a long-term care facility attached. That co-located relationship is very common in Alaska in many ways. It's a perfect solution for Alaska's far-flung population to have long-term care and acute care together. In fact, our mission at the hospital is to build this continuum of care. And over the years, we've added ambulatory surgery, we've added cardiac care, we've added oncology care. Same thing's going on in the Kenai, for example, right now with the radiation center. Same thing is being discussed down in Juneau. But this building out of a continuum of care is a key concept in Alaska. Andy represents the behavioral health side, which is a very special need. in Alaska, and I'll touch on that as it impacts us, and then referrals are made to Andy. And Lori represents long-term care. Alaska is very fortunate to have some of the finest long-term care in the country. You don't see the level of care elsewhere, by and large, that you do in Alaska. It's a long history of it. Certainly goes back to the pioneer homes and the rich tradition of taking care of elders and seniors through that model. That spills over then in other models. Also in the audience, by the way, is Karen Perdue. And I failed to mention that early on, but Karen is most recently the former Vice President of Health Affairs at the University of Alaska. Was absolutely instrumental in setting up the nursing program that helped staff the Kodiaks and the Bethels and the Fairbanks and the areas outside of Anchorage. Also, of course, over 8 years as health commissioner in the state, longest serving health commissioner, and has just been instrumental in her health imprimatur is all over the state. We're very fortunate to have her as our executive director. Overview. Alaska, beyond rural when compared to other states. And if you look at that far right column, the bed density per 1,000 miles, and just look down the column, I simply want to point out 576.5 miles I'm off on Hawaii there, 3.4 beds per 1,000 miles. Staggering statistic. And so what does it mean for a hospital? Well, for us in the interior, we think about that golden hour with a cardiac arrest and getting people into the hospital. We think about recruiting this vast area and people's bias towards rural and trying to find highly skilled providers. It's the mile wide and inch deep phenomenon, which I'll talk a little bit about in a moment. But most important, I think, for all of us in the state is how do you create a center of excellence when you are so far flung? You cannot be completely staffed with all specialties. You cannot be all things to all people, et cetera. I was talking with Representative Guttenberg earlier, whose family had some health issues right around the Christmas holidays, and lo and behold, those specialists that you had hoped would be right there over the holidays are not there. We are not 2 feet deep in expertise and talents, given that far-flung nature. So, what we do, we want to do well. We want highly trained, certified, competent, constantly pushing the envelope, skilled providers, high technology, and that is a constant challenge. We cannot do all of those things, and we have to focus on those that we do well. Quick snapshot of what our association looks like. Roughly 19 sole community hospitals. Many of those are very small in rural areas. Three military veterans hospitals, tertiary hospitals of Anchorage, psych and behavioral health hospitals, also Anchorage long-term acute care, standalone and standalone nursing homes. Again, that large number, 19, represents this co-located nature of our service. And with that comes efficiencies of scale.
Okay. Representative Rebel?
If you don't mind, I think you said you wanted questions as you went along.
Please.
What my question to you is a lot of people are saying there's going to be a shortage of nurses, a shortage of doctors. We had a presentation earlier about the ability or the lack thereof of places for these nursing students to go and get trained. I'm wondering, do you have any teaching institutions or any nursing? I mean, do you allow nurses into your program so we can get more trained up here?
Sure. Great question. A couple of quick comments, and then I'll turn it over. Of course, the WAMI program and the relationship of the WAMI program with the University of Alaska and the Providence system in particular is a robust program. In fact, you can receive your medical degree without leaving the state now because of that WAMI affiliation. Outlying areas have area health education centers, which are typically associated with medical schools. In Alaska, we're the only state that is not affiliated with a medical school, but in Fairbanks, for example, this center provides academic opportunities for rotations and training, and last year we saw 1,000 students come through that program. We have a very strong relationship, again I'm going to speak about Fairbanks and I'll turn it over, with the university. On average, a cohort of 15 nurses come through, we'll hire about 12 at the hospital. So it's very exciting to see. We also have an affiliation with the DO school out of Yakima, Washington. We do a lot of rotations through surgery with those programs.
Lori, you're in.
As far as the nursing homes, our participation certainly is not at the MD level, but training CNAs, nursing homes, certainly in Anchorage and other areas, including Fairbanks, we work in helping being preceptors for CNAs as well as nurses as they do their clinical rotations. So as far as nursing homes, that's how we participate in growing our workforce.
Yes. At North Star, we have affiliations with about 12 different higher education institutions, and they're in different disciplines. We have two nursing practicum programs where the nurses can gain experience through several of our different facilities in psych, which is much needed in Anchorage. We also have a LPN training site as well. We have a fellowship program with the University of Washington for psychiatrists. We get, as an elective, generally around two a year. We have recruited one so far, but certainly as a site, it gives us an opportunity and exposure to bring people into Alaska that want to stay here. And the remainder of those educational affiliations are with groups such as master's level clinical social work programs, psychologists, recreational therapists, and other disciplines that fit within our hospital potential educational and supervision opportunities.
Just as an aside, as we struggle with the high cost of building an academic center, these partnerships and affiliations are probably the best way to recruit and retain. University of Washington, DO School, 12 affiliations Andy mentioned. It's probably the best way to bring talent into the state most cost effectively. Another key issue is our status as an employer. The graph indicates the growth, the highest, I think, healthcare, the strongest, as you read Alaska Trends, et cetera, growth opportunity. In the state, healthcare in general represents 31,000 jobs. Hospitals and long-term care, specifically 16,000 jobs. Half of that half of that employment is in hospitals and nursing homes. But it's important to keep in mind the role physician offices play, outpatient care, growing home health programs. Less intensive service areas than that hospital, but you get a quick glance that hospitals and long-term care have a significant presence.
Yes.
Throughout the state, we're scattered. The important implication here, I think, is the struggle that and challenge we have in assuring appropriate certifications. Those urban areas with school affiliations with more a stronger or larger population, sometimes specialty services are looking for specific certifications that suggest a level of competence, which is great, and that's wonderful for the Junos and the Anchorages and the Fairbanks. But in outlying areas, in our employment is throughout the state, we may need other creative solutions in order to train and provide education for those who may not be able to travel and spend the time, et cetera, for a certain level of certification. But it's the conundrum I think all Alaskans have as you try to provide the very best across both the urban and rural divide.
I had seen a pie chart a while back on the jobs in the state of Alaska, and in the healthcare profession, I don't know if you've probably seen the same pie chart I did, but we're behind oil and gas, which is the biggest employer. I think we're second or third, right?
That would be right.
If I remember correctly. Were we second on that chart?
I don't know, but it's right there.
It's right there, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I believe it was in the top three as well.
Thank you.
Since we're talking about numbers, I thought.
It's huge. It's healthcare is an economic anchor. In
Canada, right.
There's no question.
It is. Okay.
Relative to overall costs, and this is a concern as we grapple with the concept of medical tourism, going outside, what is the cost? And of course, cost of living in Alaska generally regarded as 30% higher than the U.S. Hospital costs are 38% higher. What is that attributed to? Labor, hard to recruit positions. We have made inroads, as Representative Reinbold had asked that question, but affiliations with schools have helped. Recently, Alaska Hospital Nursing Home Association sponsored a perioperative consortium training program for surgical nurses, one of the most specialized areas of a hospital. Very difficult to find and train and keep for a long time. And I think, as Representative Higgins would say, as he's in the ORs, you want the same crew in there, and you want a good crew. And we recently, after about 6 years, have finally eliminated all travelers thanks to this internal training program. But it's a cost, and it's a cost of building that that workforce.
Representative Reinbold, you had a question?
I do. And while we're on this, it says Alaska costs compared to comparison states. Who do you consider comparison states?
Largely Region 9, the northwest rural areas. So it's the Montanas, the Wyomings, and the Idahos, and the Washington, Oregon.
But I will tell you, though, it is kind of fun talking to the nurses that you guys rotate up here in the OR. And there's a culture shock to the state. So,
what do you see in particular when?
Oh, they just actually they enjoy being up here.
Yeah.
You know, for the I think they're you guys bring them up about 6 weeks at a time.
Right.
Or
mm-hmm.
Is that what it is?
Typically, that's it.
Yeah, and they do enjoy their experience. In fact, one has this was like her third rotation up. I don't know how you guys do it, but anyhow, I sometimes it's kind of fun talking to them.
It's also a way to get an idea if someone wants to stay, and we will keep some of those travelers too.
Okay.
Let me just turn it over to my colleagues and talk generally about this idea of what are these drivers on high costs. We've talked about labor. We think about construction in Alaska. You're working from the Arctic to the rainforest. Some of the most active seismic activity in the world and the construction implications that brings out. But Andy, what are you doing?
My organization is owned and operated by a company in the lower 48, and I am the only Alaska center. And so when I look at my peer nursing facilities and their free shipping, I'm very envious of that. And the cost comes glaring through. So even things like linen, you wouldn't think shipping pillowcases would be a big deal. But it does become a big deal. It's a huge expense to get pillows and food and lifts and slings, sometimes double the cost. I've had bills for products come up where the shipping was more expensive than what I actually received. It does drive cost up substantially. And when I look at my peers, and I came up here 4 years ago from Indiana thinking, wow, the rates are great, but now I understand why. Just to be able to take care of my resident population, it takes a lot to get the stuff here to do that. It's a huge impact, and trying to tell the Alaska story to my company has been a big part of what I have done over the last 4 years.
Just kind of to add to that, I think we're very, very fortunate that we have the military bases here, both in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. They not only do I appreciate their military service, but we are fortunate enough to employ many of the spouses and family members that accompany them. But that also means that they're sometimes transient employees. So they're here and they're 6 months, they're a year and a half, depending on how long they're here. So a lot of times when that happens, it does mean that we have to plan for how we're going to recruit, when we recruit, how we get them in here to try to do timing on those particular issues. I think it's difficult. And kind of a funny story to maybe highlight, Lori, that our company has 200 facilities, and our company CFO always compares food cost per meal. And so he always puts the biggest spenders, which includes us, on food cost per meal, and says those are places you want to eat. So it kind of gives you an idea that, you know, we're explaining to them why a gallon of milk costs so much and how much it is that is the rise in that 38% above what you're seeing in other places. But it certainly is also impactful when we're recruiting, because the cost to recruit, particularly when you are paying people to move to the state, is an added cost that a lot of others don't have in the lower 48 in terms of sign-on bonuses or recruitment fees that would allow people to move and be here in Alaska.
Question came up earlier, who are your peer facilities, and here are some of the peer hospitals we look at: Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, North Dakota, Oregon, Washington, Wyoming, U.S. average. And again, just want to point out clearly Alaska enjoys a higher pay scale, and at the same time there's a downside, and that is what it adds to the total cost of care. About a 20% difference between Alaska and the U.S. average.
I'm sorry about that.
Just a comment. Healthcare finance is a strange beast, and one of the complexities is this issue of uncompensated care, and that which is not paid, co-pays, deductibles, uninsured. Through our ERs, take on everyone who presents at the ED, by law, that is our obligation. It is also the mission of our organizations, and it has been since time immemorial. This cost, though, when self-pay patients arrive at the ED, 10 years ago, roughly 20%. We were able to collect 20% on a self-pay account. This past year, it's been 5%. You can see the changing nature of uncompensated care within our facilities. What happens to that? Well, it's essentially shifted to other payers. It is made up somewhere. And what it does for me, this issue of serving all who come in, is tease up this question of Medicaid expansion. And our industry is supportive of this Medicaid expansion. We've had some discussions with a number of legislators here, and had a very good discussion with Senator Coghill just an hour or two ago. And on the front end side, obviously, 40,000 Alaskans in the next 10 years would be covered. $1.1 billion in new federal spending would be brought into the equation, would add $1.2 billion in salaries in Alaska, $2.5 billion in increased economic activity. It's all great and good. On the other side, it is a cost, and what happens when that federal share is or is not there? As we're talking to Senator Coghill, his comment is we're just exploring different ways, and we want to keep this dialogue open, is what if there was a copay? What if there was skin in the game? That has not been an issue in the past. It has not been considered, but perhaps that is one way of looking at it. And as we had a very good exchange, would just like to say this could have a tremendous economic benefit in the state, and maybe there's a way of addressing that concern on the federal question. Yes.
Go ahead.
So would you advocate for a copay?
Yes, I would advocate
what
for.
What percentage?
I don't know what that would be. It would talking with Senator Coghill, it would probably have to be some kind of tiered mechanism of some sort, so those who could not afford it would have a better break, and those who are closer to affording it would pay a larger share. I don't know what that would be, but I understand. I think everybody understands that sense of accountability, and that would be a reasonable. And
I'm so supportive of this because it seems like a lot of times I worked in the medical for a long time, and if they don't have skin in the game, they don't show up at their appointment,
right.
And then that's lost revenue for the hospital or the doctor's office, and they're trying to decide should they bill, should they not bill, and if they do, that's fraudulent, and it's like that it's lost revenue. So it's just this thing where if they had a copay, then they'd probably be more likely to show up. So this, you've totally caught my attention.
That's great. We'll take this, and I want to also mention Senator Coghill's interest in this, and he was pushing it in the last 4 or 5 years, getting no traction. But it only makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll take it as a charge and work with our association, maybe bring it forward and see if we can do so. At least we've got, in talking with the governor group, governor earlier, he said we've got some time. Let's work this through right now. Obviously, oil and gas is on everybody's plate, but we would like to just throw that out as maybe there's some opportunities. Just so you know, where does the money come from? In Alaska, 32% roughly Medicare, 20% Medicaid, big piece of the pie, obviously. And we know that is a significant issue we've all got to grapple with. 30% on commercial, self-pay, roughly 17%. Just want to get that snapshot. If I could just take 2 minutes, I'll just touch briefly on FMH, on Fairbanks, some uniquenesses. We all have them. And then I'll turn it over to Larry and Andy. Again, sole community provider, close relationship with the Native community. 21% of our patient base is Native. 90% of the admissions are within that core area. We do support quite a bit on the slope and out to the west and to the Canadian border. But for the most part, it's on the 30-mile radius. Native and military relationships, very strong. Chief Andrew Isaac is a clinic that, up until about a month ago, was the only Native clinic embedded within the walls of a community hospital that we are aware of. It goes back to 40 years ago when there was going to be another hospital built in town, and both the Native leadership and community leadership got together to address that issue within Fairbanks. It's worked out very, very well. Military also, we're a military town, two bases, lots of collaboration back and forth. Before the new hospital, Bassett Army Hospital, was built, the OB unit went down for a week. All patients transferred over and accommodated by the hospital. Our CT machine goes back down. We're over at the military hospital. Joint Commission, regulatory planning, mass casualty planning. Andy had mentioned the spouse of the military, tremendous part of our workforce. It's a good thing. It's really a great relationship. Top diagnoses, normal delivery, psychosis, alcohol, which unfortunately is probably high on the list of all of our facilities, except for long-term care and pneumonia. Economic impact, 1,350 employees, 170 salaries, 316 gross revenues. Always a capital campaign. Hospitals are always moving and changing. It's exciting to put in radiation centers and cardiology centers, but I can tell you we had more people through our new cafeteria that opened a week ago than we've seen in any of those facilities. Entire town flooded in. Couldn't get served. What's interesting is a few local leaders over the years, after a 100-year flood in 72, stepped forward to build a hospital. And I think of those two or three truly key people probably have resulted in employment of about 10,000 people over the years. And I think one person can make a difference, one person can make a difference. With that, let me just hit a couple of other challenges and sources of pride. All hospitals are concerned about niche providers. When you set up a surgery center or an imaging center, what impact does that have on your your desire to provide this full array of services. If you're in a niche provider setup, you're advocating the value of competition and ease of access. If you're on the hospital side, you're advocating how do we take care of a larger group of people. Chronic inebriates is an ongoing issue with us. We work closely with the police special task force that's 10 years old and one difficult effort. Assisted living is a great need in Fairbanks. Aging surgery facilities, we're doing some planning there now. Adolescent behavioral health. Sources of pride, I mentioned this community, Native military partnerships. Physician recruitment, we've recruited 70 physicians over the last 6 years. Again, it's probably the solution for Alaska as opposed, in my opinion, to a medical school. And then this concept of a continuum of care, and I would suggest most hospitals or communities in Alaska are looking to build a continuum of care where it's possible to come in the ED, transfer to a floor, into surgery, perhaps transfer to long-term care and back to the physician's office as seamlessly as possible. With that, I will turn it over to Dr. Mayo.
Did you want to do?
I think we hit most of this.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Obviously, as I mentioned before, I work at North Star. We have five different facilities. We have a 76-bed acute facility that houses the only child and preteen mental health acute units in the state. We have 40 adolescent male acute beds in the main building. At the Bregal treatment facility, it is solely a 36-bed treatment facility for adolescent females. The two in the bottom right, DeBar Residential Treatment and Palmer, are both residential treatment centers or longer-term residential centers for children who have been through multiple acute care stays and continue to have difficulty controlling their behavior or their environment. Then we have Good Samaritan, which is an outpatient clinic. And those constitute about 200 beds and probably about close to 20 practitioners in the outpatient clinic. If you'll pardon me just a minute, who do we serve? As we described, the age groups, our child unit is 6 to 10, and our preteen units are 10 to 12, probably the most difficult units for me to go on as I go and talk to patients, just primarily because most of the time the issues that involve what brought those children to our hospital are what was done to them, not what it is they have done. It is, and I would invite you to come take a tour with me sometime if you're in town. We have the distinct male and female units provide us an opportunity to treat the youth in separate settings that deal primarily with those issues. I would tell you from a mental health standpoint, I heard you tell your story earlier, and it was extraordinarily powerful to hear you discuss your son. And I would tell you those are the kind of stories that we're hearing every day from different family members, whether that be my brother, my sister, my father, mm-hmm. my grandfather, and things that are occurring in there. It is extraordinarily emotional. We have a tremendous amount of dedicated staff to address those issues. The residential treatment centers, one of the things is we have the level 5 treatment center, which is a semi-secured unit, and then one of only two locked level 6 units in the state of Alaska. We're also the only Tri-West provider for military children needing residential care in the state of Alaska. We work a great deal with API, which is obviously the state hospital for overflow issues, being as we're ourselves and API are the two largest providers of behavioral health in the state from a facility-based perspective. 30% of our admissions, if you're wanting to know where they're from, are coming outside the Anchorage bubble. So if you're looking at whether that be north, southwest, here, and from this region, I would tell you we get a lot of individuals who travel to our facilities for treatment. If you look at the primary diagnosis, mood disorders, which are your depressive diagnoses and bipolar issues, sorry about that.
You could also see, obviously, substance-related disorders, as Mike would say. A lot of our youth, unfortunately, are engaged in such behaviors. PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder. For those of you, I know Mike mentioned, I'll mention trauma-informed care would be one thing, and disaster planning. Two of the things that were in the state health plan presented by Commissioner Struer when he did his presentation on the 18th from DBH. Clearly, developmental disabilities. We see a lot of children, unfortunately, with the results from cognitive delays, potential head injuries, FASD, those types of issues. Our demographics are 56% male, 44% female, 48% Caucasian, 30% Native Alaskan, 7% African American, and then you see a breakdown of 3% Hispanic and 3% Asian with 9% other. So we've got a very diverse population, probably more so than what you might think because of both the people that moved to Alaska and the military bases provide us a great deal of diversity. Thank you. As I've mentioned, the five facilities, our salaries and benefits are a little in excess of $22 million. We have about 425 part-time and full-time employees. We spend about $700,000 a year, give or take, in contract services, mainly from local vendors, about $900,000 in purchase services, and about $2.3 million in supplies. The challenges that we face, to Representative Ronald's question, as RN recruitment continues to be important to us. I think in our field, more so than even the medical care arena, there's a high degree of burnout. Young ladies and young men can be very challenging at times, and it, from a burnout perspective, it's difficult. Continuity of care. I'm real proud of the fact that our recidivism rates for our facility, as we track those, we're running 5.2% in 30 days and about 17.2% in greater than 180 days coming back to our facility, which is outstanding and much better than the national average. But I would tell you what makes that challenging for us is our ability to find outpatient providers to follow up for care for these young men and women so that I don't see them again. I think being an acute care stabilization facility, we are able to try to get them to the point of stabilization, but then we need other providers out in the community to be able to help progress those issues further down so we don't have to see them again. Telemedicine growth. I think I heard the tribal organization discuss telemedicine, the need for providers. I think it's a potential solution. Mike and I have even discussed that between our facilities as we refer back and forth to one another. I think there are some opportunities in telemedicine both for you guys to consider as we more formalize those plans. We right now are doing telemedicine in our facility where individuals can get on their home computer and video a family session with them in our facility, and it is the neatest thing, and parents are so happy to see their kids. I wish you could see their faces when they get to see them when they're in treatment. It's really awesome. But as a result of that, what we didn't realize, pardon me, was that the internet feeds for those families on the computers during the hour for that family session are exorbitant. The further you get away from the major metropolitan areas. So maybe there's a way to subsidize that so families can more freely participate. Again, that's not an issue about financial issues for our facility, but for these families to be able to participate in treatment. Specialty care populations, there are things that are still going to be challenging, eating disorders, folks who have those diagnoses. There's not a quantitative mass to provide a program for them, and going to continue to see us proceed to use some outpatient, out-of-state agencies for that. We still all have to adapt to health care reform and what that's going to mean. Effective prevention strategies. I think, you know, as you guys look at the state health plan and you look at the statistics coming out of the state in terms of suicide, domestic violence, and substance abuse, they continue to rank in the top 10 areas that we need to address. And I think we need to continue to find ways to put in prevention efforts that are going to make a bigger dent in what we're aiming at. I'm proud of the fact that you guys all helped pass the Jason Flatt Act for us last year. We were able to give out and mandate suicide prevention training in the schools, I believe, above. It was age 7th grade or 9th grade and above. We gave out 80 sets of materials for every school in Anchorage, and I think it was 400 for every school in the state for those individuals and schools to be trained. We were happy to do that. Again, the only TRICARE provider. We've had a pretty stable medical staff. I've had, in the 4.5 years I've been there, we've lost one physician and I've recruited 3 others. We've got 9 total, and I'm pretty proud to say that if you give me an opportunity to get them, I can keep them. But I need to get them here, and we need to attract them here. The educational affiliations we discussed, our facility was recognized by the Joint on APES BIPS performance, as we did a great job with outcomes. We have outcome studies in which we pre- and post-test our children in all of our units. We give that data to 2 professors in status and statistics over at the University of Anchorage, Alaska, and we are producing statistically significant outcomes on our children. I'm extraordinarily proud of that, and we can prove that kids get better in our care. CEU programs is something we discussed as well briefly, but we had over 2,000 people we issued CEUs to that were professionals to help keep them in state and reduce their expense from going to the lower 48 for training. I see us doing continued growth in specialty services. Autism is an area that I think is needed for state services. Continuum of care growth for us. We are primarily an agency outside of our outpatient clinic that is youth-driven, and I think it is important for us to consider doing adults as well, which we'll do in the next 2 years. The telemedicine issue I had discussed, we've got to continue to recruit MDs for the outpatient services, and we've got to continue the training and education efforts that we had all discussed earlier. Thank you very much for your time and putting up with me, and now I'll turn you over to Lori.
Thank you, Andy. I'm Lori Dotis, and I'm the administrator at Prestige Care of Anchorage. I vowed not to refer to it as the former Mary Conrad Center, but some of you might understand the former Mary Conrad Center. Prestige took over in 2009, July of 2009, and that's when I showed up on the scene. We're one of 2 long-term care providers and subacute providers in Anchorage, primarily serving the Anchorage and the Mat-Su areas. We're one of 6 freestanding nursing facilities in the state of Alaska, and as Mike said before, most nursing facilities are co-located with hospitals and sole communities. 97% of our admissions are coming directly from acute care. I'd love to say people are really pre-planning to come to the nursing home, but they're not. It's after a fall or some kind of acute illness that we're getting the call. Our average length of stay, I'm proud to say, is 946 days. They come and they like to stay. It's a fine balance between being a medical facility and a home, and we try our very best to make our residence room and their court, as we like to call it, their home. They get to decorate the way they like to decorate, and we've been remodeling over the last several years to really make it a comfortable, beautiful place to live. And for our Medicare and HMO residents who are coming just to rehab and reintegrate into the community, 58 days is our length of stay. Because we run so full, it's the same beds turning over and over again. 79 admissions and 79 discharges last year, 1 for 1. Our mix is a little bit different. Statewide, 90% of long-term care patients are Medicaid or are on Medicaid. We're at about 85%. We do have a wonderful relationship with the VA, so we have about 7 residents right now who are paid for by our VA contract, and 15% of our population is there for short-term subacute rehab services. Just under 50% of our population has some kind of dementia, short-term impaired cognition diagnosis. So a lot of our residents are still actively engaged in life, going out into the community. We have a vehicle that takes them out to lunch, to bingo. I don't go to bingo, but I wish them the best of luck. I'm sure many of you have seen these numbers. By 2020, we're going to double in our senior population, and by 2030, it's almost going to triple. Most of our facilities are running almost at full occupancy. I'm running at 97% at all times, and I'm sure my competitor in town is about the same. In our rural communities, I'm sure Mike's building is running pretty full as well. There's going to be a bed issue, and it's one of the issues of the long-term care community is going to have to address sooner than later. And it's one of the things that I think we're all looking at, certainly as an association, and but it's something on the radar map. As I said before, average for Alaska, 90% of long-term care services in Alaska are paid by Medicaid. Most of our facilities out in the rural areas, those short-term patients are being served actually in swing beds in the hospitals, and the long-term care patients are served then in the nursing home. Our admitting diagnoses, again, people aren't planning. As you can see, most people are having a fracture or some kind of neurological event, usually a stroke, and that's how they end up at my facility. Some cancer, some renal, but it's some kind of traumatic event that's landing them there, and depending on their scope of treatment, how they're rehabbing, depends on whether or not they turn into a long-term care patient or whether they're able to go home. Most of my population is requiring at least one, if not two people, and 26% are requiring usually a mechanical lift to move them from chair to bed. That requires a lot of manpower to take care of these patients. Currently, we're employing 144 employees. We have an all-time low turnover right now at just under 30%. It's been a long road to get to that number, but we're really, really proud of that. We have an annual salary and benefits of $8.1 million. That includes our contract therapy company that Prestige owns with another company. Gross revenues of 12.6, and we just received an approved certificate of need to add 12 beds. Now, obviously, that's not going to meet the silver tsunami coming, but it is 12 more beds in the Anchorage Bowl to help start meeting the needs. And this might not seem like a big deal. It might just seem like a financing statement, but to my staff, this was a big thing. In 2012, Prestige Care, which is based out of Vancouver, Washington, purchased our building. And this is the first time that this nursing home has been owned and operated by the same company. For my staff, that meant pride of ownership. It meant that they're there to stay. That meant they were really committed to the elders in that community, and it had a huge impact for my residents and for my staff alike. It was a big day, the day that financing went through and I could say we own the building. So I think the building's 26 years old, and to say we own it was a big pride factor. Last year we won the Bronze Quality Award by the American Healthcare Association. A couple of years ago, we are the recipient of the Mountain Pacific Quality Health Excellence in Care. We are the only five-star rated center for quality ratings that measures pressure ulcers, how well we vaccinate our residents. It measures urinary tract infections, and that's listed on the CMS website. And again, we are owned and operated by a leading Pacific Northwest long-term care provider. Thank you.
Are there any questions? No? Well, thank you. We appreciate your presentation. It was very informative. And if there's anything we can do, make sure that you contact us, and we'll see if we can help you, okay? Thanks. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, with that said, our next HESS committee meeting will be at 3 p.m. on the 21st. We'll begin next week meeting with a presentation from the Alaska Brain Injury Network, which will be followed by the first hearing of House Bill 90, Vitamin D Supplements. The time is now 4:40, and we will gavel out. Meeting adjourned.